This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Merry Christmas. I'm Jeremy Hobson. And joining us on this Christmas Day is an old friend we've spoken with many times, the former mayor of Memphis, Tennessee, A.C. Wharton. He served from 2009 to 2015 and is now working as an attorney. He's here to talk about some of the big stories of the year. Mayor Wharton, welcome back to Here and Now and Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Chairman. The same to you.
So I want to start, I want to talk about a lot of things with you, but I want to start with the economy because that is what got us to meet in the first place. Back in 2010, we were talking about the recession and how it had hit the city of Memphis. So now, 10 years after the financial crisis and the Great Recession, do you think that it has left a lasting impact on your city, or have things gotten better enough that you would never know it happened?
I won't say we never knew it happened, but it is in our rearview mirror now. We still have, as you may recall, too many blighted and uncared for homes as a result of the excesses in the housing market. We have not rebounded fully from that. I don't think any city has. It'll be a while. But beyond that, we are in the midst of a strong rebound. Unemployment numbers are down, even in the African-American and the brown community here. Building is just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I checked a couple of days ago. It's $13 billion worth of new construction, either just completed or underway. Many employers, new employers, are moving here with higher-paying jobs, as a matter of fact. From up your way, Mimeo just announced that it's moving its headquarters here with 300 white-collar jobs. So we're on the rebound. We're not quite there yet, but we are much, much better than we were in 2010 and a year or so after that.
And what about politically? Tennessee is a state that, while many other states in this country have been moving further to the left, Tennessee, it appears, is moving further to the right. You just elected Marsha Blackburn to the U.S. Senate in a race that was supposed to be close, and it really wasn't in the end.
That's correct. I won't say we're moving. I think we're just solid to the right on the conservative side, outside a few bastions such as maybe just right in the core of Nashville, Memphis. But generally, your assessment is correct. It is still a very, very conservative state.
Why do you think that is? What's different about Tennessee than, let's say, Georgia?
We're still a rural dominated, both in terms of the legislature and the agriculture. Long ago, I used to say that Memphis should secede from the state because we were so different. But a lot of it has to do with the makeup of our state legislature, which, as I said, in terms of your committees and all, are dominated. Legislature is almost 100% Republican, and of course the leadership certainly is, and that leadership is reflective of who the people are. It hasn't always been that way. We shifted from Democrat to Republican. I don't think there was one single factor that, like hitting a switch, moved it to the right, but that's where it is now.
One of the big issues that's just been tackled in Washington after many decades of work is criminal justice reform. This bill is going to be the biggest change to the criminal justice system in decades. Do you think, as you look at it, that it's going to make a big difference?
Oh, it will. Let me tell you, Jeremy, before I got into politics, I was a criminal defense lawyer. A lot of my work was done in federal court on the crack cocaine cases, and I saw so many young lives just absolutely ruined. Mm-hmm. I happened to defend the first major crack cocaine bust here in this district. A young man from a great family decided on a lark he wanted to make some big money on one deal. I think he got maybe 35 or 40 years, young black man. So it is going to make a big, big difference. The further reduction of the cocaine and the crack cocaine disparity, you're going to be shocked at the difference it's going to make insofar as urban populations are concerned and what the makeup of our federal prisons are. You know, Jeremy, I'm old enough to remember when to get into the federal prison, you couldn't buy your way into a federal prison. Those crimes were all handled at the state level. But 10, 15 years ago, everything was federalized. And what really troubled me about that, and I argued against it, we always heard that, look, the federal government should not overreach. The role of the federal government is not to combat street crime. But back then, we flipped the script, and we still have not been able to give a good justification for that. It's just that you had longer penalties in federal court. So it is a hallmark. It is a transformative step. And I, like many others, would never say, oh, that's. I'm glad the president did that. More specifically, I'm glad Jared Kushner did it.
Right.
But it is everything it is being held out to be.
Okay, well, after that praise for Jared Kushner, I want to ask you about some of the divisive rhetoric that's come from President Trump. He's called Maxine Waters, an African-American congresswoman from California, low IQ. He has questioned President Obama's citizenship, obviously. He criticized African-American NFL players for taking a knee during the national anthem as a way of protesting police violence against black people. How have you felt as you've watched all of these various controversies about the president's rhetoric on race?
If you know anything about me, I was always of the conciliatory mood, always trying to bring races, economic groups together. It just hurt. I know that might be a wimpish term, but it just hurt. It was like pouring gasoline on the smoldering fires that were burning, smoldering in our urban areas. I cannot think of a better term than to say hurt, crushed, to see that coming from a leader of the free world. I don't think it did anything to better the plight of our nation, our cities, and it was just hurtful.
What about the substantive things that have happened on the issues of race, the relationship between police and African Americans, the removal of Confederate monuments, including right there in Memphis? Do you think that big things have happened in that regard, or are these just small issues?
They are big, and if you will note, all of those efforts have been sustained. Those were symbols of the worst of America, and albeit we still have so many maladies we need to address, it was so much in your face. I would have to drive to work every morning, and I would deliberately not look to my right because I'd have to see that man on a horse, and knowing everything that that man stood for, it's a bad way to start off your day. So I think it is of critical importance.
Finally, Mayor Wharton, how are things on the outside of politics? You left the mayor's office a couple years ago, and now you're an attorney. But what do you think? How are things?
They're good. Of course, I work with St. Jude. I mean, that's like heaven. Who can be against that? I enjoy that. Working with a number of groups who are seeking to improve the welfare of children, I am quite happy and content in what I'm doing. I would say to all politicians, there is a life after politics, and don't worry about having to leave it.
And who would you like the next president to be?
Oh, I'm not going to touch that.
Why not?
I tell you what, I'll give you the a general description. I've done a lot of work with the Brookings Institution, and of course, if you look at where we are indeed a metro nation, and in terms of the educated populace, the patents, the discoveries, the centers of learning, centers of medical care are all in our cities, our urban areas. I would generally say that that individual, she or he, has to be someone who really has an ear to the ground for the needs of urban America. That's as far as I'm willing to go at this time. I will say that there are any number of excellent prospects out there, particularly on the Democrat side.
You know, Mayor Wharton, I have to say, after all these times of speaking to you, I still just love listening to you talk. I feel like I would go to a reading of, you know, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas if you were reading. Why don't you host a radio show?
No, you know, I do love it. So if anytime you running into something, you want somebody to ramble and talk, give me a call and I'll be glad to weigh in on it.
Great. Will do. Mayor, thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Take care.
That is A.C. Wharton, former mayor of Memphis, Tennessee, now an attorney and founder of the A.C. Wharton Group. As we end 2018, we're listening back to some of our favorite stories this year. Yesterday, we heard the first part of our story about Daniel Grossman, a childhood friend of mine who's now a doctor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. We visited him in May. Last year, a mountain biking accident left him paralyzed, starting a few inches above his belly button. He's had to relearn how to do basic things like lifting himself or transferring from his bed into his wheelchair. And from his wheelchair to the ground and back.
And reposition my feet.
Yep.
Be straight. Bring my knees in.
And you want to tuck them back as far as you can.
Yep.
That was more than a year ago. Today, Daniel's more comfortable in his wheelchair and has gone back to work as an ER doctor. But he's still concerned about falling out of the chair, something that's already happened to him a few times, including while he was staying at a hotel near the Mayo Clinic.
I was transferring from the toilet to my wheelchair, and I missed the transfer. I'd practiced this transfer a whole bunch of times, but I missed it, and I ended up on the ground. Now, I had also practiced getting from the ground up back onto the chair, but it's different to do that in physical therapy on a mat than it is to do naked in the middle of a tile floor with the chair not solidly held or against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I called a nurse from Mayo, and she came and helped me get up. And that was my worst fear.
How are you?
Good.
My goodness.
On the day we visited, Daniel took us up to the third floor of the hospital, where many doctors recognized him. This is where he started learning how to navigate the world from a wheelchair.
This is the acute rehab unit, and I was up here for 64 days. So this is the room I was in, 42. It was home for 2 months.
What is it like to be back here?
It feels good. I mean, I graduated from this place, and sort of it feels like a bit of a homecoming and a bit of a graduation. And
how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Back to work, I see you.
Back to work.
Jeez. No rest.
Hey, can't rest. Got things to do.
Yeah, you do. Got life to live, right? Good to see you.
You too.
So you feel like you have good memories of this place?
Yeah, look, I hated being here from the sense of I'm in the hospital, but it was really good for me. The nursing care is fantastic. The physicians are great. And I, at the end of the day, have really, really positive memories of learning how to get back on my feet, so to speak. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
We brought it in.
Dr. Kristen Garlinger leads Daniel's rehab team at Mayo. She pops out of her office to tell Daniel how impressed she is by the speed of his recovery.
I think that, you know, settle. It takes a special individual to take barriers and make them into opportunities, and I think you were that way before injury. And so that's kind of what gave you the upper hand compared to maybe other individuals who don't have that inherent personality. Yeah.
Personality matters in other areas of life as well, including dating. Daniel is single, and I asked him about that. What about the single part? What do you think that your relationships will look like in the future?
I would love to be in a relationship and would love to have children. That is a primary goal of mine. And so therefore a big fear of mine as well. But plenty of stories exist of people starting relationships after having spinal cord injuries and having children. I don't see why that would be any different for me.
Have you had a date yet?
Yep.
Yeah?
I've had a few dates, and it is a self-selected population because I'm pretty upfront about the fact that I'm in a wheelchair. And so either they're okay with it or they knew me before.
Hmm.
Is it easy? No.
It sounds like none of this is easy.
None of this is easy. It will all become easier. It's only been 9 months.
Right.
And I have to keep that in perspective.
According to the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, people with spinal cord injuries are 2 to 3 times more likely than the general population to show signs of severe depression. People with spinal cord injuries are also at a higher risk of attempting suicide. You wrote in one of your early blog posts, because you started blogging about what was going on, that you were able to be mostly in good spirits, but you were sometimes sad and it would come and go.
Yeah, early on, I think I realized what the ramifications were, not just for me, but for everyone in my life. And I sort of had to pick between two divergent paths really early on. Option A is you are paralyzed. What are you going to do about it? Option B is you are paralyzed. Let's sit and wallow in self-pity.
Hmm.
And I decided for option A. And honestly, I think most people do decide for option A. But option B seems really easy. That like self-pity component seems pretty reasonable.
There are approximately 300,000 Americans living with spinal cord injuries. And Daniel's not the only one who's also a doctor. One is Dr. Francisco Sanchez at Harvard, who recorded himself doing procedures to help Daniel learn how to do them. Another is right here at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert Brown, a neurologist who has used a wheelchair since he was 14 and who became a mentor for Daniel during his recovery. And you've got, by the way, a perfectly pressed suit on, a perfectly tied tie. Daniel's been talking to us about how difficult it is sometimes to get dressed.
Yeah.
How'd you make this happen?
Well, as Daniel perhaps mentioned to you, I've used a wheelchair to get around for a long time. Mm-hmm. This dates back, 40 plus years. And so this is the type of thing you just get used to, if you will, as years go by. And one was one of the things Daniel and I talked about when I first got to meet him. And we talked about this transition to the new normal, if you will, in Daniel's life and the various aspects of one's world that one needs to get used to as you participate not only in your personal life but in your professional life. You just get very used to how to put things together in the morning, you know, as you're getting ready to come in. And
you just get used to it.
You get used
practice
to it.
Practice makes
it,
perfect.
And it doesn't take very long. It probably doesn't take me a whole lot longer than it would somebody who's not using a wheelchair. My message to Daniel was that one's life can be absolute, as full, and as much of a celebration of life as it would have been prior to the accident.
One of the things our listeners can definitely hear from you is you're very upbeat.
Yeah.
How important is the attitude? And have you said anything to Daniel about that?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that early on. And my immediate perspective as I got to know Daniel in that setting is he has a very upbeat personality by nature. And that's the way I was as well. When I was initially paralyzed 40 years ago, and I think my parents would be the first to say this, I was the one who was trying to reassure them that this is going to be okay. You know, we'll just work through it over the course of time. It'll be fine. And that was just in my nature at age 14 that for whatever reason, and I think it's a very good thing that it was the case, that the more you're able to appreciate what you're able to do, despite the fact you're using a wheelchair to get around, as opposed to the things that you can't do or an obstacle in your place, you're going to be much better off and readily be able to work through whatever obstacles that might be in front of you.
As we continued to talk to Dr. Brown, Daniel was listening across the room. He wheeled over to say something himself.
So we've talked a lot about inspiration. And when you rolled into my room the first day, pristinely dressed, and you didn't treat me like a patient. You treated me like a colleague. And that, for me, was actually inspirational because you came in and said, you know, you can do all the things you want to do. And you have one choice to make, and that is, do you want to do the things or do you want to choose an alternative path, as you described? And I want to say thank you because you immediately alleviated my fear of travel. You immediately alleviated my fear of not being able to get back to a profession that I cared deeply and passionately about. And you showed me that you can live professionally, you can live personally, and you can do all of these things successfully. So as much as we've harped on the word inspirational, the impact you made on my life when you came and visited multiple times without any difficulty was incredible, and I want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. It means the world to me that you say that, Daniel. And as a colleague and now a close friend, it's just fantastic for me to see how well you're doing. And for many, many years to come, I'll look forward to assisting in any way I can.
Thank you.
Daniel still keeps the helmet he was wearing the day of his accident. It's cracked, but it also saved his life. He's also started biking again, on a bike operated with hand pedals. And since we first aired our story, Daniel took his first international trip in a wheelchair. Before his accident, Daniel had traveled to more than 60 countries. He says his recent trip to London was a major hurdle to a feeling of normalcy. We've got photos and videos of Daniel at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
2018 was a huge year for the burgeoning electric scooter industry. One company behind the scooters, Lime, says it's now in 130 markets around the world and that users took 26 million rides this year. The industry has caused some disruptions, including for drivers. Over the summer, we met up with Paul Christian, a 30-year-old Uber and Lyft driver in Austin, Texas, and asked him about the scooter craze.
They're kind of cool, I guess, but at the same time, I see a lot of people doing some unsafe driving habits when they're on those scooters, like going the wrong way on one-way streets, running through stop signs, red lights, and I'm just kind of worried that someone might have an accident later, especially because I see them a lot downtown, and that's where people are drinking, and I just don't know if alcohol and scooters is a good combination.
Well, Paul Christian joins us again. And Paul, are people getting the hang of them? Are they driving a little safer on the scooters?
Well, not necessarily. You know, I hear a lot of people that have just done it for the first time, and they're saying that they basically started out on top of the scooter and ended up underneath the scooter.
Huh. Why?
Just, you know, maybe they don't have the kind of driving skills of scooters to do it safely, but, you know, they just ended up in the grass for some reason.
Have you ridden one?
I still have not ridden a scooter.
What do you think of them at this point? I mean, do you think that they've been good or bad for transportation there in Austin?
You know, overall, I think it's a good thing. You know, anything that takes cars off the road and, you know, is just like a green way of getting around, I'm in favor of. And I know that Austin's doing a pilot program right now where they're testing out getting some of those scooters out on some hike and bike trails. I think it's going to go for like 9 months, and they're going to see how it ends up, how many incidents there are, talk to the public, and just see if they're going to make it permanent.
Now, meanwhile, when we talked to you, you mentioned that you are firmly in the gig economy as somebody who drives for these new companies, Uber
yes,
and
sir.
Lyft. So how does that feel right now? Are you able to make enough money to do what you want to do?
You know, sometimes it's tough, you know, because I don't have a steady paycheck. I just get my money from the gigs, you know, so sometimes I'm left a little bit strapped towards the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. And you also do a little real estate on the side. Are you still doing that?
Yes, sir.
And what's the market look like right now?
It's poised to get just even better because I think Apple just announced that they're going to open up a new campus in the area.
Right,
so that's
right.
going to make the property values just kind of go crazy. The only thing I'm worried about is the people that maybe can't afford the housing market out here getting squeezed even more.
Are you still planning to pursue a career in acting in Los Angeles?
Yes, sir.
When's that happening?
Hopefully in May of this year. That's kind of the artificial date that I've set for myself.
So we're just a few days away from the new year, Paul. What's your resolution for 2019?
Less social media when I wake up.
Really? Why?
Because, you know, you get into arguments on social media and it just kind of takes up your day and there's just a lot more productive things that you could be doing. Maybe I could be writing a blog about the things that are happening in this world instead of arguing with a stranger on Twitter about it.
Yeah, and you're still on Facebook?
I'm still on Facebook, Twitter.
You haven't been scared away by all the privacy scandals yet.
You know, I really got upset about that, but at the same time, I find a lot of like acting gigs on Facebook, so I can't completely pull away. And yeah. I just like the memes.
All right. Well, we will link people to at least your YouTube page where they can maybe give you a job in Hollywood at hereandnow.org. Paul Christian in Austin, Texas. Paul, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And let's take a look at a few of the year's biggest science stories as we close out this year with Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent. Joe, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And one of the most controversial issues in science happened just a month or so ago. Chinese scientist said he edited the genes of twin embryos, and this was greeted with shock and outrage in the scientific community. Tell us more and why it's so controversial.
Well, the reason is that there are two kinds of cells inside your body. One are the so-called somatic cells. And these are the cells that make up your skin and organs and what have you. And when you die, they die. That's it. They're gone. It's over. And a lot of diseases are thought to be curable by fixing these somatic cells. So if you have a sickle cell disease, mm-hmm. you might be able to treat the cells with some sort of gene-altering thing that would correct the sickle cell damage, and then you'd be fine. There are another kind of cell inside the body, which are called germ cells, and I don't like that name. It probably is there for a reason, but it basically refers to eggs and sperm. And the difference there is those are the cells in men and women that are carrying the genetic instructions that get passed on to offspring. If you mess with the genes in a germ cell, in a sperm or egg cell, that is going to be passed on for generations. And that seems to be crossing an ethical line that people are very uncomfortable with because it basically means we're tinkering with humanity, not just one individual, but with our species.
And that is what this scientist did. And he did so using CRISPR, which, if I remember correctly, is one of the stories that you told us about last year, was one of the most important things in science was CRISPR. And now here he is using this technique to alter the DNA of a human being.
Exactly. And CRISPR is still one of the most disruptive, momentous tools that has come to biology in years. Believe me, people have thought about how could we change the genes here? How could we fix this there? It was a very labor-intensive process, and CRISPR basically just makes it a whole lot easier. And so these questions, which seemed hypothetical at one point because, oh, it's way too hard, we could never do that, now suddenly, oh, yeah, you could do that. And now someone has done that, and it got everybody up in arms.
Okay, so that is one big science story of the year. Another one comes from outer space. This was a great moment. NASA's InSight probe landed on Mars in November. Here's the reaction in the control room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Touchdown confirmed.
Okay, and then we spoke with Bruce Bannard, who was InSight's principal investigator the next day after the landing. Here's what he told me.
the time it takes for a radio signal to get from the Earth to Mars or from Mars to the Earth is about 8 minutes right now. And so since it only takes 6.5 minutes to go from the top of the atmosphere to the surface, it's actually already landed by the time we start getting telemetry back that it's starting the process.
This was just a remarkable feat. Explain what it was that they're doing and why it was so amazing.
Well, yeah, and I was sitting at JPL about a couple hundred yards from the control room that you just heard cheering, and there were several buildings and a large courtyard in between, and you could almost imagine you could hear the cheering all the way across the campus. It was a thrilling day. It's just crazy difficult to land a spacecraft on another planet. And it makes people nervous. The guys who are going to have to land the next one, or the guys and gals, if you'll forgive me, that are going to have to land the next one are terrified because now they think the expectations are high. Everybody thinks this is easy. This mission doesn't rove and it doesn't scrape up dirt. It has a seismometer that will measure Mars quakes and a temperature probe that will measure the temperature of flow of heat through the planet. And the whole idea is that by studying these things, Mars quakes being the Martian equivalent of earthquakes, right. They will be able to understand more about the deep structure of Mars, because all the other missions have, as they like to say quite literally, just scratched the surface. And when you look at seismic waves, they propagate through the entire planet and you can begin to learn things about the interior of Mars. So that's why they're excited about this mission.
And one thing that scientists did learn about the interior of Mars this year is they discovered an underground lake.
Yeah, well, that was a cool one, and that came from an orbiting spacecraft, a European Space Agency spacecraft, and yeah, it seems like there's this briny lake underground. Mars, in the first pictures that came back, looks pretty barren. I mean, pretty dead. And the idea that there's actually water sloshing around someplace is a kind of an exciting thought, because it's possible, very possible, maybe I could only say possible 12 times and it wouldn't be enough, that there could be life in this water. So
I thought you were going to say that we're going to ruin this planet and have to go there and we'll need water. there was also this year, Joe, the Parker Solar Probe to the Sun, by the way, which we shouldn't forget about, which is going to go and maybe learn a little bit more about the Sun. But a big loss I want to talk to you about in science this year, physicist and author Stephen Hawking died in March. How much did he influence science and culture during his life?
Well, that's a very interesting distinction that you just made. Culturally, he was a phenomenon. I mean, if you put genius and Hawking together in the same sentence, everybody would say, well, of course. Okay, so what did he do? Well, I'm not really sure. It's what most people would answer. He had very, very thoughtful and important things to say about the nature of gravity and the nature of black holes, and the specifics of what he's done are really, really dense to get through. But everybody who worked with him, knew him, was totally impressed with his intellectual prowess, and the fact that he was, as you remember, in a wheelchair, unable to speak for most of his, almost all of his adult life, and accomplished so much, was a thrilling thing. And he was a very puckish guy. He liked to do crazy things. So he was on The Simpsons, and he was,
right,
I think, on Star Trek. And, you know, he would do these things that intellectual geniuses were supposed to be above somehow, and he wasn't.
There was a very destructive volcanic eruption in the United States this year, Hawaii's Kilauea volcano. Here's a resident describing it on CNN.
All we heard was a boom. What is that? And then all of a sudden we smelled the sulfur dioxide. We knew something was happening. Within minutes, we seen smoke, and now we see all this lava coming across the street, and it's pumping right now. So this fissure is opening up.
The eruption began in May and lasted until early August. Why did this make your list of the most important science stories of the year?
Well, it was, you know, it was a natural disaster of a sizable proportion. I mean, there were over 700 dwellings destroyed, mm-hmm. and 30 miles of road was damaged by ash. And the other thing was just the volume. I mean, 875 acres of new land was pumped out by the lava that hit the water and solidified. So it's a big one. I'm a little bit loath to say that it was the big science story of the year, but it seemed colorful and impressive, and so we included it.
And we, of course, had natural disasters related to the weather, a lot of people making the connection with climate change and how much the climate is changing. What have we learned about that this year?
It's really a great example about how science progresses, the understanding of how the climate is changing and how that climate change is affecting weather patterns in various parts of the world. I can tell you that 30 years ago, I was writing about climate change, and there were scientists then who were sending out the message saying, we must do something about this. This is going to be terrible. And we're convinced that there's going to be sea level rise and tremendous changes in the weather. And it's not that people said, oh, well, that's nonsense. They just said, well, we don't really have data. Now we have data. And the connections that people were predicting were going to happen have begun to happen. And you can see this play out. But it's not like, aha, I've discovered climate change. It takes place over a long period of time. And now people are pretty convinced.
Now people are pretty convinced. But as everybody's been saying all along, we got to do something now about this. Do you get the sense, looking forward to 2019 and beyond, that there is hope of reversing or at least slowing global warming?
Well, what do they say? Hope springs eternal. I mean, I'm thinking that the nations of the world got together in Poland at the end of the year and set up a framework for how to measure and understand what was happening and possibly reverse it, or at least keep track of it, and some suggestions about how to slow things down. So, yeah, I mean, who knows when we've waited too long. I hope we haven't waited too long already.
Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent, looking back at 2018 and the big science stories with us. Joe, Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
When you think about dementia, you may jump straight to the health effects on the deteriorating mind. But what about a person's confidence? Andrea Aswahe of member station WBUR takes us to Northern Ireland to meet a man working to restore a sense of pride to those who are slowly forgetting who they are.
Jim Gray no longer looks like the athlete he used to be. He uses a walker to get around. His legs sometimes give him trouble. But Jim still remembers the days he used to strap on boxing gloves and climb into the ring.
I fought for Ulster.
You did not?
Oh, I did. I fought against Germany.
In boxing?
Uh-huh.
Well, don't be boxing me today if I do anything wrong, okay?
Jim is bantering with his friend Lenny White. It's not the first time Lenny's heard about Jim's boxing days. He's heard about them many times before because Jim, in the early stages of dementia, repeats himself.
In the very younger day, I used to box, you know. I fought for Ulster, so I did.
The unlikely friendship between 37-year-old Lenny and 81-year-old Jim began just this year. But Lenny's work with the elderly dates back 20 years. And he was a dishwasher at what the Irish call a care home. Even though he had a passion for caregiving, he decided to pursue a more lucrative career. He spent nearly two decades working in sales. But Lenny wanted a job that would give him a sense of purpose.
I knew that I was called for something, but I didn't know what. And I was always searching for what do I want to be.
In his search, he learned about a course to become a barber. It piqued his interest, and by 2016, he had his diploma. Then, an idea struck him.
I remember back when I used to work in the care home all those years ago, I used to watch the hairdresser taking the wee ladies and going out, and I thought, I would like to go in and do a men's day.
Lenny thought, what if I provided hair care services to elderly men? What if I could pamper them? So he reached out to a local care home, and they were interested.
So basically, I'll go in, it's a pop-up barber shop, I'll set up the barber pole, I'll bring the jukebox for the music. So they're walking into that shop and they instantly recognise the pole, they recognise my barber cape, they recognise, there's Lenny, he's the barber, he's coming in.
2 months into his barbering gig, the Alzheimer's Association reached out to Lenny. they wanted to train him to care for people with dementia.
I'll talk to them quietly. I'll bend down to their eye level. I will say, "This is Lenny. I'm a barber. I'm here to cut your hair." Maybe if they're very agitated, I'll maybe sitting, if I'm maybe shaving them, for example, I'll maybe even hold their hand while I'm shaving them with the other hand.
Lenny's business grew rapidly, and so did his passion for the job. He had finally found his calling, a career that gave him the fulfillment he was seeking.
I am the world's first dementia-friendly barber.
Now Lenny visits 55 care homes on rotation. At every stop, he cuts hair, trims eyebrows, and provides clean shaves, small gestures that give the men back their confidence.
There you go. 10 years younger, Jim. And that'll do you for a few weeks, sir. All right, that's you finished.
I get a lot of people saying, you know, my dad, you know, I knew that he was getting bad whenever he stopped shaving. And that would have been something, his appearance was very important to him. It's so important for their families, especially, you know, when they come in and they go, that just looks like my dad. You know, thank you so much.
Lenny's days aren't always easy. There are times he works with men who are far along in their dementia and become easily agitated.
Some of them are in their final stages. Every 6 weeks I return to a different care home, we find out that Jimmy isn't there, that Sammy's gone. But how I deal with that is just, I just try and be positive. You know that I've done these men proud, that they're looking good. I am these men's last barber, you know, and that's a privilege.
Lenny says he's honored to do this work, and the thought of bringing joy to these men, even if it's just for a fleeting moment, is worth every tear shed over a final goodbye. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Aswahe.
Andrea's story is part of WBUR's Kind World series. For more information, go to hereandnow.org. Our Christmas Day staff includes Mark Navin, Karen Miller-Medson, Savannah Marr, Eileen Balinski, Mike Moschetto, James Trout, Todd Munt, and Kathleen McKenna. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Merry Christmas. This is Here and Now.